the Allstate Skyline Studio.
WGN Radio presents A Conversation.
I want to make one thing perfectly clear.
A dialogue.
What are you prepared to do?
An astute debate.
Everything within the law.
And a peek behind the curtain of politics.
And then what are you prepared to do?
I think Chicago is not only the center of the country, I think it's the center of the world.
Don't tread on them.
Where did this statement come from?
This is the Sunday Spin. Your host is the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson.
Good Sunday morning, everyone. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune, and welcome to this edition of the Sunday Spin for February the 3rd, 2019, the first Sunday of the shortest month of the year. This is our weekly look at the world of politics and policy as we take you from City Hall to the State House and all the way up to the White House. So time to grab that Sunday paper, get that hot cup of coffee. We'll do our best to get your week off to a good start. Well, I told you we'd all survive the polar vortex, right?
Well, once again, we are here.
We're here.
43 at O'Hare, 44 at the lakefront.
I mean, the 60-degree temperature shift and flirting with 50s tomorrow.
Yeah, that'll make it 70.
Yeah.
To go along with this, though, Rick, I just want to mention very quickly some flood advisories in effect for Lee, Ogle, and Winnebago counties. They are until further notice.
The Rock River?
Yeah, they began around 9 o'clock last night, and these flood advisories continue until further notice. The same thing holds true for Grundy, Kankakee, and Will counties. That is a flood warning for those counties, Grundy, Kankakee, and Will counties. That Kankakee River stretch there that is frozen, they're very concerned about that.
Yeah, I'm sure. And, I mean, they're... I don't mind the warmth, but we all kind of knew that that was going to be the aftermath of that.
Especially, this is the first time I've ever experienced this, where it's warmed up this quickly after having such severe cold.
Yeah, and I know that there is a fog warning,
right?
But nothing downtown.
No. No, it may be in the further in the outlying areas.
Right.
There, although, you know, with obvious moisture around us, the lake and the river and everything, we've seen some pretty dense fog here since we've been in these studios. But
well, we've seen a lot of dense things in these studios that aren't necessarily with a lot of fog involved, I think, too.
Right. But nothing this morning here. It's clear downtown.
Yeah. Yep. Well, polar vortex, too. And I know that term's been around forever, but doesn't it sound like something from a Svengoolie movie?
Oh, you know? Yeah. Right. I think it was on last night.
The attack
when they were
of the polar
the giant
vortex.
Claw that was on last night.
So is every just deep freeze going to be called a polar vortex now? Is that what it is?
Well, now, did the Weather Channel give it a name? You know, like they were starting to do winter storms like hurricanes where they gave these things names. I don't know.
Because I remember a couple of years ago when we got hit with that frigid temperature and everyone was calling it the polar vortex. I thought it was like a once in a lifetime type thing. I was ready to make T-shirts and I survived the polar vortex. And now I got to put part two on all those T-shirts.
How many of those did you sell?
Not too many.
No, I mean, the term's been around for a
while. The term has been around, and it refers to the extreme cold air that is around the polar area, the North Pole. And we've had
the jet stream coming from the North Pole.
We've had jet stream and pressure systems that allowed that to open up and give us what we had last Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday.
Well, it's nice to see the wind shift and the jet stream shift south. And
didn't it feel balmy out yesterday?
Oh, did it ever?
It smelled like spring.
It did.
You could smell the snow melting.
I even think I saw some tulips.
Oh, please. No,
just kidding.
Cut it
just
out.
Kidding. Just kidding.
They're speaking of dense fog. clean those glasses, Dave, will you? Oh, wow. But no, and well, and for, you know, the recuperating right wing, it was no choice but to stay inside.
And no snow shoveling for you.
No, not at all. Not at all. But, well, it's nice to bring the warm weather back. It's Super Bowl Sunday. What are we doing for the Super Bowl, guys?
I'll be in a nice, quiet evening.
Okay.
Watching the game and staying in touch with. Well, I guess friends on both coasts, California and New England, especially New England. I was telling you off the air, Rick, I've got a good friend that moved back to Boston where she grew up. and is an absolutely fierce Patriots fan. So I know she will be posting things this evening.
Joe, what are you doing?
Well, I was going to invite Dave over, but apparently he's got his mind set up.
To help sell T-shirts.
Right, exactly. Yeah, we got a lot of work to do, Dave.
You going to have pizza?
No, I'm actually...
Well, then I'm not coming.
Oh, sorry. I can't repay you for the coffee cake you brought in today, apparently. we always go to a buddy's in the South Loop, his apartment. Everyone brings a little bit of food and, you know, just do the whole squares, prop bet pool, food, drinks, and all 9 yards.
Do you know what the point spread is?
Last I checked, the Rams were giving 2.5.
Rams were giving?
Yeah.
Really?
I'm almost positive the Rams have been the favorite this whole time.
Obviously, I've been paying so close attention because of my intense interest
well,
in this.
Well, because I'm almost positive they were getting 3 against New Orleans in the NFC Championship.
Okay.
And, I mean, that's when you got the home team giving only 3, that pretty much means the bookmakers don't know what to
right.
do. So, yeah, I mean, the Rams have been the favorite, and even with the final 4 teams, with the 2 AFC and NFC championships, everyone was kind of favoring the Rams then. But you know what? I was talking to somebody about it yesterday. This always happens. When the Patriots play a team and the other team is the favorite, that's when the Patriots become the Patriots, and they just do their whole Belichick working around the defense and getting very creative. Whenever it's people relying on the Patriots to be the Patriots, the Philadelphia Eagles run the Philly special and things like that. New York takes down their undefeated season with 1 Super Bowl win. You know, it's always those weird circumstances.
Well, I'm thinking New England. I definitely am thinking New England. And part of that may be a little bit of geographic bias because of the fact that I still think that the folks in St. Louis got a raw deal.
Yeah. Yeah, could you imagine that? Could you imagine losing a team and then just a few years later, then making it all the way to the Super Bowl?
And I go back, you know, before the Rams even arrived in St. Louis when they were selling the personal seat licenses and, you know, buddies in Springfield were buying PSLs to get a seat for the NFL coming to St. Louis. And then you have no teams in Los Angeles. And then now how many teams do we have
now
in Los
Angeles?
Now they
get 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Chargers and the Rams. Yeah, it's. I mean, that's going to be a tough spot for Rams fans in St. Louis.
I don't know if there are any left.
Yeah.
Seriously.
Aren't there still some Cardinal fans here in Chicago that hate the Bears? That's what I've always heard. Like in Beverly, maybe there's only like 6 of them or something, but it's still a pretty cool thought.
Oh, yeah, sure.
They've been hanging with those Chicago Cardinal ties all these years.
No, I'm sure there probably are some... you know, St. Louis fans of the Rams, but I think that's a limited, very limited number.
Yeah, that's rough.
I'm very happy to hear about the Hawks with the 4 in a row.
And yeah, what a game.
And I could only make it through the second period. And I have to tell you, I was really frustrated, especially the first half of the second period when the Hawks couldn't even get across the red line. I mean, they were just getting slaughtered in center ice. And it was like, this really looks bad. This looks bad. And if you think about, you know, most of those goals, 4-3 overtime win by the Hawks, most of those goals, there were only a couple that were inside shots, you know, close to the net.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them were, you know, from fairly far out.
Yeah, yeah, they were putting a lot of pressure up at the high slot. Well, heck, I mean, I feel like the Gustafson goal should have probably been turned.
Well, both of them, quite frankly.
Overtime one as well?
Yeah.
I didn't see that. Was there offsides there as well?
Oh, no. There was a question. I wasn't aware of the offsides question on the overtime.
Got it. No, they reviewed the first Gustafson goal because of potential offsides. And, yeah, I mean, it totally looked like the Hawks caught a break there. But, you know, like you said, it just seemed like a typical Hawks loss this season. The types of games they're playing where, you know, they make a run at it and then all of a sudden they cough things up where Minnesota ties it in the final 4 minutes. But, hey, they're probably playing their best hockey right now.
Well, I had the, you know, comfort of, since I fell asleep after the second period, they were up 2-1. So it's like I'm off to dreamland. And I dreamt of a victory and they got one. And, Aunt Jo up in Minnesota did not text me knowing that I sleep in early on Saturday night, so I can expect the text later today to tell me her thoughts on the Wild loss last night.
Wow, but that's pretty responsible family texting there.
Well, I know. I'm somewhat amazed because I was waiting for that ding to go off.
Now, if the Hawks lost, do you think she would have texted you?
Oh, you bet she would have. Then she would have texted me for sure. But, so it's nice to see them winning. And 3 points still out of the last playoff spot. But it looks like they've played one more game than anybody else in the conference, too.
Yeah, everyone keeps talking about that, only 3 points away from that last playoff spot. There are still a lot of teams in
six.
Front. Yeah, I mean, that's quite a leapfrog they're going to have to do. But, I mean, if you can only control what you can control. They got a lot of home games here in February. So I said on the air yesterday, I feel like this month is going to be very telling for where the Hawks' destiny is this year.
Well, I'm still there. I'm still there.
Yeah, I mean, now's the time to have some confidence in it, you know.
And seeing Gustafson step up and, you know, as a defenseman, and, you know, he's, 10 goals now?
Right. I think he's a huge piece for this team. I'm a huge Eric Gustafson fan. I just feel like he's such a good dressing room presence. I feel like he's one of the more favorite teammates throughout the team. And when he clicks with guys like Kane, Jonathan Toews said on the air yesterday in the post-game recap that he kind of becomes like a fourth forward when he's clicking with the offense, and that just helps out their scoring.
Well, and
so
that's that was how, you know, Duncan Keith was,
right?
You know, before was, you know, you'd find him all the way down on the goal line at points and stuff. So no, it's a good dynamic, and I like how things are starting to mix. I hope it goes from mix to gel is really what it comes down to.
Right. Yeah. Hopefully they can keep this rolling.
Well, Dave's here to keep us up to date on all the news.
I have one quick question before we break.
Is it about the Blackhawks?
How many days till spring training? No, it's not. It's about baseball.
I think it's eight.
Oh, I'm liking that.
We're getting there.
Thank you.
That sounds good. Well, and frankly, there's a nice kind of setup for the Super Bowl today with the Boston playing Washington with the NHL game. And I'm betting Doc Emmerich will be having that game. And that's a good setup for tonight's Super Bowl.
Yeah,
so
that is.
I'll be watching that. So Joe's got the latest sports for us. Producer Cassera is fielding your calls at 312-981-7200. You can also text us at that number, 312-981-7200. We're on Facebook at facebook.com/thesundayspin, on Twitter at @SimpleSundaySpin. Engineer Brett is changing the oil in the newsroom Zamboni. And remember, you can find all of our shows on WGNRadio.com. You can also get our podcast at iTunes by searching for my name, Rick Pearson. We're going to take a quick break. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Time to launch our weekly spin through national politics. And there's still that continued division between President Trump and his requirement for a border wall and Democratic opposition as negotiations continue over national security funding as another shutdown deadline looms. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi made clear that Trump's wall is not on the Democrats' agenda.
There's not going to be any wall money in the legislation. However, if they have some suggestions about certain localities where technology, some infrastructure, as I said, about the ports of entry, we might need more ports of entry. We might need some roads. That's part of the negotiation. It is not a negotiation for the president, say. What did he say today? It doesn't matter what Congress does. I knew that he wanted it all to himself. I mean, oh, really? A president who wants to have Congress be completely irrelevant in how we meet the needs of the American people? No, come on.
But the president maintains the congressional negotiations are worthless without including that border wall. Asked about Pelosi's remarks, the president had this to say.
If there's no wall, it doesn't work. She's just playing games. So if there's no wall, it doesn't work. And we're building the wall right now. I mean, a lot of people don't know that, but we have a lot of wall under construction. We've given out a lot of contracts over the last 3-4 weeks, good contracts. A lot of wall is soon going to be under construction. We're finishing up design on certain areas, the most important areas, the Rio Grande area and others. We are building a lot of wall. You know, I'm not waiting for this committee. And I've told a lot of people, I don't expect much coming out of the committee because I keep hearing the words that we'll give you what you want, but we're not going to give you a wall. And the problem is, if they don't give us a wall, it doesn't work. Without a wall, it doesn't work.
Kamala Harris, a Democratic senator from California who's joined the Democratic 2020 presidential campaign. Cory Booker has also joined the campaign. Harris, in her announcement, called Trump's request for a wall a vanity project for the president.
For the people meant fighting transnational gangs who traffic in drugs and guns and human beings. And I saw their sophistication, their persistence, and their ruthlessness. And folks, on the subject of transnational gangs, let's be perfectly clear. The president's medieval vanity project is not going to stop them.
That's Democratic Senator Kamala Harris. Last week on Meet the Press, NBC's Chuck Todd asked House Republican leader Kevin McCarthy why Republicans didn't act to fund the wall when they had control of the House.
At the end of the day, why should Democrats bail out your party that had 2 years to figure out a way forward here? You said you were going to have legislation ready to go in 2017. What happened? We did. If you look at the appropriations, we are building the wall right now, a portion of it. We have to go
then
further.
Then why did he shut down the government?
He did not shut down the government. Let's be very clear. We were in the House, in the majority. We moved a bill to the Senate. You know as well as everybody else in America, it takes 60 votes. Mm-hmm. Schumer is the one who said no. So you put it on
it
the
is. DACA for the walls, the president backed away from.
No. We passed this at the end of last year. Money for the wall, more money because we're already building it. Mm-hmm. We put another $5 billion in there. The Senate had a different version, and Schumer said no, so it got shut down. Then what happened? The president stayed in Washington. The speaker then went to Hawaii. The president stayed there to negotiate. We brought meetings down. They said they wouldn't talk about anything. We got into a shutdown that lasted longer ever before. The president made four different offers that were reasonable.
Not until after he shut down the government.
He didn't shut it down.
He's the one that said he'd be proud to own it. Who else did it?
Who else did it? There's a fundamental question. Up ahead on your Sunday Spin, after the 7:30 news, we'll speak to Illinois Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger of Shanahan. We'll talk to him about prospects for another shutdown, where we are on the issue of border security, and, of course, the State of the Union address on Tuesday night. After the 8 o'clock news and sports, we'll speak to Republican State Representative Dave McSweeney of Barrington Hills. Representative McSweeney is staunchly anti-tax. We'll talk to him about the early days of the new Democratic J.B. Pritzker administration. After a final check of news and sports at 8:30, we'll speak to Bill Daley, the former Commerce Secretary and White House Chief of Staff, who's a candidate for mayor of Chicago. We'll talk to him about the campaign with Election Day ever approaching. That's all up ahead. You're listening to the Sunday Spin on WGN.
Now back to the Tribune's Rick Pearson. It's the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN.
Good Sunday morning. Welcome back to the Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio. Joining me on the phone is Republican Congressman Adam Kinzinger. Congressman, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
You bet, Rick. How are you?
Good, good, good. No shortage of things to talk about. I guess I wanted to start out with is, you know, given the back and forth rhetoric, and you talked during the partial government shutdown about people need to get off their political talking points and they can resolve this, but we've still got political talking points going on. Do you see what do you see as the chances for another government shutdown?
I don't think the chance for a shutdown is very high because, you know, I feel like we touched the stove, and even though nobody will admit that the shutdown was dumb, the shutdown was dumb. And, you know, so it's kind of like looking and saying, well, what was that all about? We don't want to do that again. You know, look, by the way, just a quick side note, everything, you know, all the news, everything is about what's going on in Washington, D.C. And, like, my burden this year is to try to make Washington, D.C. way less relevant in people's lives. Like, the Founding Fathers never intended us to dominate every news cycle, but we end up liking to do that. So I think, you know, bottom line, we end up getting through this It may be the president declaring some kind of an emergency. It may be the Democrats come off their no wall position, which I think is not a good starting bargaining point, and then we get something done. And I doubt it's going to be, you know, epic or game-changing, but it may just be enough to get us through this crisis, which unfortunately in D.C. is all we do, just enough to get us through to the next crisis.
Well, and I have to tell you, part of the reason why I've continued covering mainly Illinois state government and city government, I had my chances to go to D.C., but I always thought that the state stuff was a bit more relevant.
Yeah. Well, that's how it should be. And you know, that's where I think whoever runs for president next on the Democratic side, or when President Trump, when he doesn't run again in 6 years on the Republican side, I think their winning platform is something like, hey, my job is just to kind of manage what's going on here, make sure we lead, and then let you guys, you know, spend your evening paying attention to stuff that actually matters. I don't know. I just think that'll be a winning campaign for somebody.
Yours, perhaps?
No, not mine.
All right. Just want to check that box, okay?
All right.
About the prospects of the president declaring a national emergency on this. And, I mean, I saw a tweet from Adam Schiff yesterday about how when the intelligence community testifies at Congress and they don't even mention concerns about things at the southern border, how can you declare a national emergency?
Yeah, I'm kind of mixed on this, and it depends on where what the national emergency looks like. I mean, you know, swine flu, for instance, was declared a national emergency, but so was 9/11. So those are two very extremes of national emergencies. So there's a lot of the devil being the details. I don't like the idea of the president doing it, because I think that's, frankly, the job of United States Congress to do. I don't like ceding power to the president of the United States, because I think that Congress was where the founding fathers intended a lot of this to be. But look, on this issue, and I consider the wall a tier two issue, by the way. I don't think the wall and those issues are existential to the United States. I think they're important, but I don't think it's like the most important thing we've ever dealt with, even though everybody kind of feels like it is right now. I just think if Democrats can come off their position that there will never be a wall ever, and then Republicans need to come off their position of everything that deals with people that are here illegal is called amnesty, you know, we're going to have to deal with Dreamers and DACA, et cetera, then I think 80% of America will like whatever we produce. But, you know, right now it's just we're feeding the base, not really leading, and nothing gets done. And we're only like 2 weeks into a new term, and we're already talking reelections and politics.
Hasn't that shift from comprehensive immigration reform talk of several years ago to all of a sudden that path to citizenship becomes amnesty, hasn't that really been kind of the trigger on why we haven't gotten anywhere?
Yeah, I think so. I think Republicans had an opportunity. Now, I say this as a Republican because I know more intimately what was happening within our party, and there's plenty of blame to go to the other side. This is everybody's blame here. But on our side, we had an opportunity, I think, in 2013 to really do a big immigration reform package. And then some of these kind of far-out-there voices who, frankly, make money on making you angry and making people angry and making them mad. That's how they make their money. These voices began to say that the Republicans were selling out and doing amnesty and not going to get border security. And from that moment, it was 2013. And I remember I was part of it. We have been locked in our position, unable to really discuss this issue. And we're going to have to deal with this. You have millions of people here illegally that you're not going to deport. So the question is, do we give them a pathway to become legal and be productive members of society, or do we continue to have them work while we're not, gaining as an economy out of that? That's a pretty basic answer, I think, that we have to fix.
How much of Tuesday's State of the Union address do you think is going to be on that whole issue of the president's requirement for a wall?
If you think back to his first State of the Union, he actually put out a really good plan for immigration that both sides were for. It was border security, but also, dealing with the DACA Dreamer population and and fixing our immigration system to be more merit-based instead of just family-based. If he can talk about that again and hit the reset button, I think we have an opportunity. What I worry about the most, though, Rick, to be honest, is the lack of decorum that is now coming through the House. You know, there is something special about the State of the Union. I'm afraid you're going to have outbursts or protests or something, and I hope that's not the case. It'll be an interesting speech to watch. I hope the president is presidential, because he certainly can be sometimes, and I think we have an opportunity. But everybody's got to quit, you know, just for like a week, quit looking forward and saying, when is the next election, when's the next election, and let's just actually govern for a little bit.
Well, and you talk about lack of decorum, but isn't that kind of the emblematic of, you know, one of the problems, not only in politics, but of our society today?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, all you have to do is, you know, Twitter's a useful tool. But go on Twitter sometimes, type my name in, you know, probably type your name in. And what you see is that on the internet, people, because they can be anonymous, they unmask their really kind of mean side. And that's pulled the decorum out of society in general. I remember only probably twice in my political career have I ever had anybody come up to me and yell at me in public. It's quite different on the internet, though. I think only twice in my career anybody said anything nice on the internet. So not that I care, but it's that is seeping into society where we're all not treating each other like we ought to.
I'm curious, too, about the decision by the U.S. and subsequently Russia to pull out of the INF. And
yeah,
where is that sending us?
Well, I think it's what we need to be clear about is, you know, Russia's decision to pull out of the INF yesterday was in name only, because they basically have. They've been testing and developing an intermediate nuclear force for basically the last 10 years. And, in fact, you know, President Obama called them out for the exact same thing. I think this is the right move, because it basically says, you know, we're going to hold our partners to, if we're going to hold ourselves to some restriction, we're going to hold the people we sign that with to as well. So this is all this does is basically lift our restriction to be able to match Russian forces. I don't think this is going to lead to a massive arms race, but I also think it's clear that the Russians want to rebuild the old Soviet Union, and they've found ways to do that through, you know, obviously building their military and sharpening their teeth there, but also through trying to undermine democracies like meddling in elections and undermining the very foundation of democracy, which is your ability to vote and know that your vote counts. So, look, I don't think Russia is an enemy, but they are certainly a chief competitor, just like the Chinese, and it's important for us to see them as such.
Well, I mean, but as you say, you don't think this would lead to any great arms race, and that Russia has already been looking and developing those weapons. But, you know, given kind of the climate of, you know, Russian attempts to interfere in our elections, you know, cyber warfare, and then, you know, this, I mean, how does it not lead to just kind of this multifaceted kind of arms race?
Well, I think you're right. I would call this a mild Cold War. I have to be careful, because I'm not saying that we're, you know, far back when it used to be, but I think there is a mild Cold War. And this started when the Russians decided to invade Ukraine, when they invaded Georgia. They still occupy a third of Georgia. They still occupy parts of eastern Ukraine. There's separatist areas near Ukraine that they're trying to Transnistria. All these areas, and then obviously their foray into Syria to keep up Assad, their decision to meddle in the 2016 election. I think we have to fight them on all fronts. And part of that is, if they're going to play this game of quote-unquote fake news in the United States, we have to fight back offensively on their internet and with information as well. And it's almost like a mutually assured destruction on the internet. You know, you try to hack our election systems, we have ways to get back at you too, so you think twice about it. So it doesn't mean we're going to go to full war. And by the way, if we ever did, the United States would crush Russia convincingly, but I don't think that'll ever happen. But it is pushing back in areas where they're trying to undermine our democracies and those of our friends.
One more thing I wanted to ask you, and you touched on this about, you know, Russia propping up Assad in Syria, and obviously President Trump's desire to have U.S. forces out of Syria. But is there enough pushback that exists in Congress to prevent that from happening?
There's certainly a lot of pushback. I have met with the president personally twice on this issue. I'll tell you, he's very introspective about it. I do think he's been listening to the wrong voices for too long on this stuff when it comes to, hey, he just wants to bring the troops home. I think America really just wants to win and wants to be safe. So, Congress is going to push back. You know, there was some maneuvers in the Senate, but ultimately the president has a lot of leverage as the commander-in-chief. I think if he completes the decision that, you know, he wants everybody home from Afghanistan or Syria, there's not a lot Congress can do to overrule him. And I think if that decision comes through, it's going to end up being one we look back on and regret. Similar to, and I'm not just taking a pot shot, but similar to, you know, when President Obama declared Iraq free and safe and prosperous, and we left in 2011, and ISIS rose a couple years later. So I hope the president reconsiders. Nobody wants to be in these wars forever, but we also, the only way America can lose is if we lose our will, because we'll never lose on the battlefield.
Lose the will and create a vacuum, and the vacuum gets filled.
That's right. That's right. It always gets filled. It always does.
It always does. Congressman, I understand you have to run. Congressman Adam Kinzinger, Republican from Shanahan, thank you so much for joining me on the Sunday Spin.
Yeah, it was great. I enjoyed it. Take care.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio overlooking a Chicago River that is actually starting to see some water flowing through it as the temperatures thaw. Continuing our look through national politics, we have, of course, joining the presidential campaign, the former Starbucks CEO, Howard Schultz. Schultz has been catching a lot of heat from Democrats who fear that an independent, like Schultz plans on running, an independent bid could siphon votes and get Donald Trump reelected. Schultz appeared on Fox News, and he offered some advice for Democrats.
I think the Democrats need a little bit less caffeine right now, is what I think. I think they've over-rotated completely, because it's very possible that if I run for president as a centrist independent, that more lifelong Republicans will come my way than Democrats. So I think the whole thing is just an overreaction in 24 hours. Let it all play out. Let people get to know me and let the story get out.
Kind of an interesting faction here. You even had Michael Bloomberg, who, you know, switched parties various times and becoming mayor of New York, and basically saying the same thing as a lot of Democrats, that an independent bid won't work. It's very complicated. It's very difficult to do, to get on the ballot in all 50 states, and ballot access laws being what they are. That being very difficult, but also Bloomberg sharing those same fears as well, that it's something that somebody can talk about. Even Donald Trump talked about it at one point. It's another thing to actually do it, and if you were to get on the ballot, then he'd play just a spoiler role, because getting elected would be awfully difficult. Also in Washington, and I mentioned this with in our discussion with Congressman Kinzinger about issues about the White House intelligence team, and Trump lashed out at the intelligence team on Twitter after they disagreed with him on Syria, ISIS, Iran, North Korea. Trump on Twitter said, hey, they should go back to school. Then on Twitter, he shows a picture meeting with his intelligence chiefs in the Oval Office and saying, well, the media mischaracterized what they had to say. Which, of course, was demonstrably false, because they were basically, the story was playing what they said. So, for example, here's one of those mischaracterizations coming from Dan Coats, who had this to say about North Korea and Trump's vow that the North Korea would denuclearize.
The regime has halted its provocative behavior related to its WMD program. North Korea has not conducted any nuclear-capable missile or nuclear tests in more than a year, and it has dismantled some of its nuclear infrastructure. As well, Kim Jong-un continues to demonstrate openness to the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. Having said that, We currently assess that North Korea will seek to retain its WMD capabilities and is unlikely to completely give up its nuclear weapons and production capabilities because its leaders ultimately view nuclear weapons as critical to regime survival.
So that's the National Intelligence Director, Dan Coats, basically saying, yeah, they can talk about pulling the nukes, but don't count on it happening because it's essential in the minds of North Korean leaders to their survival. Also, we had former New Jersey governor, unsuccessful Republican presidential candidate Chris Christie, out with a new book, and it attacks the early formation of the Trump administration. That was back when Christie was looking for a gig and actually was even heading up parts of the transition committee, only to find his work disavowed. On Fox News, Christie said the continued failure of Trump to fill appointments is hurting his chances to win a second term.
We're now into the 2020 campaign.
Right.
And I think it's going to get even harder for people to, if they have a lucrative situation in the private sector or another really good public service job they don't want to leave. I mean, I think it's important for him to redouble his efforts. Those empty desks don't produce any work.
That's right.
They don't produce.
They can't help you.
And you need momentum from the bottom pushing you up as much as you need momentum from the top pushing down.
Yeah.
And he hasn't had that. And that's one of the real tragedies that I write about in the book. He could have had that. And he didn't because a bunch of selfish people, most particularly Bannon, Rick Dearborn, and Jared Kushner, decided to throw the transition out and do it from the back of an envelope in 71 days.
That's former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie discussing his attitudes towards the Trump administration. You're listening to The Sunday Spin on WGN. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. My buddy Todd Gilman from the Dallas Morning News is on the White House travel pool and just sent out this note that about a half hour ago, the president arrived after a brief drive from Mar-a-Lago to the Trump International Golf Club. Not clear yet who he's playing golf with. Yesterday, of course, the president was playing with Tiger Woods and Jack Nicklaus. So we'll be keeping an eye on the pool report, and we'll get updates as warranted.
This is the Sunday Spin on 720 WGN. Once again, here's Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune.
Welcome to the second hour of your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. As those temperatures begin to warm up, was out on the WGN Storm Center patio and not really seeing the fog that was kind of in the forecast, but I'm sure it's probably going on. There's enough moisture in the air. But thank goodness for the warmer temperatures finally, something to be very grateful for. Well, joining me now on the phone is Republican State Representative David McSweeney. The representative is from Barrington Hills. And, Representative, thank you so much for joining me this morning.
Good morning, Rick. Great Hawks victory last night. We're on a roll.
Yeah, and you stayed up and watched it, too, I bet.
I did. It was actually a good overtime victory. In fact, that was a quick overtime. I was happy.
Well, I'll take your word for it. I was only able to catch the highlights this morning for the part I missed. But yes, it's nice to see them on a roll. Let's see how long it can last. Speaking of on a roll, I'm curious about your thoughts about the new administration of Democratic Governor J.B. Pritzker. In having spoken to Republican leaders of on both sides of the Senate and the House, there was a lot of we're optimistic, a lot of, you know, let's wait and see, looking for a sense of normalcy to return to government. I'm kind of curious, where do you fall on that scale?
Well, I'm not seeing any sense of bipartisanship yet, Rick. You know, the first day on his during his inauguration speech, he said that he was going to use his political will against the opponents of the progressive tax. And by the way, I call the progressive tax the jobs tax, and we could talk about that. I think raising taxes is the wrong answer. The second day in office, he said that he was going to raise the pay through these step increases for state employees without telling us how he's going to pay for it. Then he said a series of press conferences that I think is trying to appeal to his base on the left. Just rubbed everybody's face in this HB 40, which is the unlimited taxpayer funding for abortion. And now, at least, you know, the reports that are coming out on a preliminary basis is it looks like they're going to try to move very quickly on a increase to $15 for the minimum wage, which I think would be bad for jobs in this state. So I'm not seeing any signs so far. I mean, he has dinner with the leaders, and that's about the only thing I've heard, but I've seen no substantive proof that there's actually any bipartisanship yet, but hopefully that'll change.
Well, as far as the $15 minimum wage, and these are things that Pritzker did campaign on. It's not like this is some kind of a hidden agenda. I mean, let's be frank. But as far as the minimum wage, I remember having Rob Carr on the show, and I'm seeing reports of like kind about, you know, having basically where I guess the business community is accepting the fact that the minimum wage is going to increase. It's just a matter of how it does, and are there ways to perhaps lessen the burden? And, you know, Rob Carr has talked about, for example, can we do it in a geography-based way where cost of living is not equal in all parts of the state of Illinois? Also, it seems that there would be certainly some kind of phasing in. And then there's always the issue of youth wages, as well as, I guess, frontline restaurant workers that get tips. I mean, it's not just a, you know, flat, this is the minimum wage. There are all kinds of intricacies involved.
It's going to be interesting to see how this plays out. I spoke with Rob Carr today. I have a lot of respect for him. I don't think he's on board for any specific proposals consistent with what he told you. But my concern is that what it's going to do is just result in less jobs in the state and moving people to a part-time basis. It's not going to have the intended effect. And we'll have to see how this plays out. And there's a lot of speculation now that they might try to move very quickly before the budget address on February 20th. I hope he doesn't do that, meaning the governor. I hope that they take the time, they receive the input from all parties. I think it's just a bad idea, period. But we definitely should not move quickly on this. And you know, to your point, Rick, remember this governor spent $171 million of his own money, and he ended up getting only 54% of the vote. So I don't think there's a mandate for his policies necessarily, but we're going to all hopefully work together to try to make this state a better place. We have major problems, but I'm not seeing any proof so far that there's any major bipartisanship.
Do you just disagree with any increase in the minimum wage?
I do. I mean, it's $8.25 at this point. I would rather create an environment that is more conducive to jobs. So, for example, I filed a bill that would eliminate the taxes altogether on manufacturing companies that remain in this state. That includes pass-through companies that are owned by small businesses. I would rather create manufacturing jobs in this state, especially downstate in the south suburbs of Chicago. That's the real problem, is we're losing manufacturing jobs. And those are high-paying jobs that usually are $15-$16 jobs for the minimum. So I'd much rather see it that way, which is to create new jobs than to create new mandates. I mean, we're seeing what's happening in other states, and especially in the restaurant industry, is when you raise the minimum wage, what's happening is you're effectively just reducing the number of jobs, number one. Number two, they're moving a lot of people just to part-time status. That's not the intended effect. I would rather create high-paying jobs by creating a better environment for businesses to locate in Illinois.
When you talk about manufacturing jobs, and yes, they're higher paying jobs, and it's much more skilled than it was in the old days, but to have them, you know, perhaps locate in economically distressed areas, not just in Chicago but downstate, is what you're talking about enough incentivizing, or, you know, do you need to provide some kind of incentives to locate in counties that, you know, are pretty devastated?
Yeah, in fact, I have another bill, which is piggybacking on the federal Opportunity Zone bill, which actually allows investment, again, tax-free into certain areas, and it would create, under my bill, $100 million investment program in Opportunity Zone. So expansion of enterprise zones, Opportunity Zones, and economically depressed areas, I think definitely is the way to go. And that's one of the areas I'm hopeful that the governor will work with us on, and he has a successful business background and with 1871 and understands the importance of investments. So I'm hopeful that's one of the areas that we've worked on together.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because of the fact that, you know, he does have a business background. Now, granted, you know, he has a progressive agenda, but the fact that he does have a business background, does that temper any concerns?
Well, it does. I already like him on a personal level basis better than Governor Rauner, who got along with nobody. I certainly have major disagreements with Governor Pritzker on policy, but I've met him a couple of times, and he seems at least willing to listen, unlike our previous governor. So I think that's a positive point, and hopefully he's going to move toward a more bipartisan basis. I've just been very concerned about what's been happening over the last couple of weeks and some of his initial moves.
But I'm more referring to, like, as far as, you know, moves that the state takes as it relates to business, and obviously.
I hope so. I mean, he's, again, 1871 was a very successful business, and I'm hopeful he's going to use some of the experience to help focus on creating jobs and doing some of the things we just talked about, specifically bringing manufacturing back in this state and creating economic opportunity zones, investment opportunities. So I'm still hopeful that he's going to reach across the aisle and that we can work together on some of those items.
We're speaking with Republican State Representative David McSweeney of Barrington Hills. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune here in the Allstate Skyline studio in downtown Chicago. Joining me on the phone, Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. And we've been talking a bit about, you know, concerns that exist in these early days of the J.B. Pritzker administration. And Representative McSweeney, we have a call from Ron. Ron, as always, welcome to the Sunday Spin.
Good morning, Rick. I wasn't able to get to you last week, but just wanted to say I'm very happy that the surgery was a success. I want to say that.
Thank you so much.
Representative Sweet, Rick pointed out when you mentioned that the governor is maybe planted his base. Well, as they say, elections have, you know, consequences, and the Democrats won overwhelmingly. So the message appears to be resonating, and I'm just concerned about the Republican Party just becoming totally relevant. So, give me an assessment. I mean, it has to be more than just talk about taxes and tax incentives. But is it the messenger or is it the message? But just kind of let me know, where do you think that the Republican Party can go to really come back, you know, being competitive? Thank you very much.
That's a great question. I think the last election here in Illinois was a failure of Raunerism, not Republican values. I mean, again, Bruce Rauner had a weird ideology, as we all know, that included a lot of other different things that was rejected a landslide by the people of the state of Illinois. So the party of Lincoln here in Illinois, the Republican Party, needs to stand firm for reforming pensions and Medicaid, for reducing unnecessary spending, and providing economic opportunity, specifically, as we talked about, focusing on job creation. And part of that message is reducing this tax burden. We have one of the highest total tax burdens when you combine income taxes, property taxes, and sales taxes. Reducing that burden and providing real opportunity for the residents of the state of Illinois. We're losing people. We've lost 45,000 people net, which includes net of birth. When you think about that, it's just amazing that we continue to lose people who are worried about the tax burden. So our message has got to be an optimistic message, which is that we're going to focus on economic growth and we're going to focus on creating jobs and a better life for the people of the state of Illinois. But it is a great question.
Well, and to that point, as a follow-up, you know, the idea of fiscal conservatism has always been a hallmark of the Republican Party, but it always seems to be the constant battling within the Republican Party between social moderates and social conservatives, and that seems to be a detriment going forward in some aspects for the Republican Party, doesn't it?
Well, we just need to unite at this point. I mean, that there's no doubt about the fact that we need to move forward together. And I don't think everything's great for the National Democratic Party either. There was just a poll that came out yesterday that in the Iowa caucuses, people intend to vote that more people favor socialism over capitalism. So there's a pretty good chance that there may be a far-left candidate nominated by the Democrats. So I think we as a party need to unify, but the Democrats are moving further and further to the left. Nationally, and as we mentioned here in Illinois, too. So I think it's going to be a competitive race in 2020 and then congressional races here in Illinois. I think we have an opportunity to pick up some state house seats, and I do believe that we need to be unified. There's no doubt about it.
Well, I guess maybe what's just happened to the middle, you know, as these parties faction out right and left? Who's there for the middle?
If you look at where we stand in Illinois is, Jim Edgar, Governor Thompson, were very successful politicians, and there certainly is a role for those people in our party, that there shouldn't be a litmus test. The issue with Rauner, where all the divisiveness was created, is the multiple positions that we're taking, that telling the truth to various groups. There isn't an issue that I've seen, if a person up front takes a stand, even if it's a stand I don't like within the Republican Party, and they pretty much stick with it. You can always change your mind on minor things. But the thing that really created the division with Rauner is it was mentally exhausting to watch all the different positions that he took with different groups. He would appear on your radio show and say one thing, and then he'd appear on Tom Miller's downstate radio show and say the exact opposite thing. So there is definitely a role for moderates in the Republican Party. In fact, an important role, and we just all need to come together. But I think people need to be consistent. They need to be able to work across. And again, I think this was really a failure of Raunerism, not the ideology of the Republican Party.
Now, I know you've talked about pension and pension funding in past, and the need to alleviate that burden. You've got legislation that you sponsored that would basically end legislative pensions. Obviously, the legislative portion of the unfunded liability of state pensions is not as significant as teachers, state employees. But I guess, is this kind of more like not that it doesn't have a financial effect, but is it more like symbolism?
Well, I think we need to lead by example. I haven't taken a pension since I was elected, and I don't think members of the General Assembly should receive pensions. But this is a real opportunity for Governor Pritzker on the major issue of pensions. He could be like Nixon in China, right, negotiating a major settlement on the union issues, including pensions and work rules and pay. And that was why I was so disappointed to see him just day one award those step increases. There is an opportunity to negotiate a global settlement. The big issue we have, we've talked about it multiple times, Rick, as you know, is this 3% compounded increase of benefits every year when inflation is only about 1.5%. If we could tie that to the half the rate of inflation and as part of a negotiated settlement and do a constitutional amendment like Arizona, that is the solution we could do. And it's not going to happen unless there's a negotiated settlement with the unions. There's a real opportunity for Governor Pritzker to do it. That's where the big money is.
But do you really think that is likely to happen in the political climate?
I don't know how he's going to come up with a budget that makes any sense unless he addresses the pension issue. And he was supported by the unions, is supported by the unions. He has the ability, I believe, to negotiate a global settlement. And that's what was done in Arizona, at least partially, and the unions actually got on board. So it's not going to just be changing pensions by itself. It's going to have to be. We have the outstanding contract now with AFSCME. We have work rule issues. We have group health insurance issues. It's got to be a part of a global settlement.
But is a global settlement, and I'm not a lawyer, but is a global settlement really achievable? Because it would seem to me that even if you had, all the unions signed on, and this goes back to, past talk about the Senate President Cullerton's proposal on consideration, even if he had the union sign on, all it takes is one member to file a legal challenge to it that could toss the whole thing.
That's correct. There's no doubt about it. But I'm talking about actually passing it with 60% out of the General Assembly and passing it 60% among the voters. I think that would be important for the General Assembly. You're never going to be able to eliminate the chance that there's going to be a legal challenge, and I believe as long as it is a going-forward test and you're passing a constitutional amendment, and what they did in Arizona is they actually codified a piece of legislation into a constitutional amendment, I think that has a much better chance. And as you look going forward, and Comptroller Mendoza came out with a report this week. I mean, that budget that they passed last year, which I voted against, you know, was obviously was out of balance, and we've got about $1.5 billion problem just, you know, in this year alone. That's going to continue to increase, and I think this great fight going forward is going to be over this so-called progressive tax, which I call the jobs tax, because that's what the Pritzker administration is going to rely on going forward. And if they don't do pension reform, at least partial pension reform, the burden is going to get greater, and the amount of taxes they want to raise are going to be even higher in the future. So I'm hopeful that that's one of the things that the governor will focus on, and I'm willing to work with him on that if he wants to reach across the aisle.
That's Republican State Representative David McSweeney from Barrington Hills. Representative, as always, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much, sir.
We'll be back with more right after this.
Now, the Sunday Spin continues on 720 WGN. Here's Rick Pearson.
Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson of the Chicago Tribune. Here in the Allstate Skyline studio, and joining me in studio is William Daley, former Commerce Secretary, former White House Chief of Staff, and currently a candidate for mayor of the city of Chicago. Mr. Daley, thank you for joining me.
Good. Thanks, Rick. Thanks for having me.
And, of course, I always get memories of one of the first shows I ever did and had you on. And that was a campaign for governor that didn't last very long.
About 5.5 years ago. Yep.
I want to just make sure you're in for this now.
Yeah.
but seriously, what, you know, back then you were gung-ho, and then you kind of said you didn't have that global examination of what it would take to do a campaign.
You know, it was a combination of things, Rick, to be frank with you. My wife kept saying at the time, you don't seem to really be into it. You know, state of Illinois is a great state. A lot of problems, obviously, but I didn't quite get into it. This, when I know this city, I've lived my whole life in this city. There are no parts of this city that are foreign to me. Quite frankly, as I traveled the state back in the summer of 13, it just didn't feel right. It didn't feel comfortable. I didn't have a sense of a feel of the issues and the parts of the state.
It was more global.
Well, the state, you know, I guess I'm a hometown local guy.
Running for governor was more of a
it was parts of the state that I really didn't have a feel for. And so my enthusiasm for going through that process, obviously challenging the incumbent Democrat, blah, 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 and lots of people told me to run, then all walked away because of the power of the incumbency and all that. But I never really felt comfortable. This, from day one, because I've lived my life in the city, I know the issues, I know the city, I'm very comfortable with it, and I'm comfortable with the fact that I think I can, hopefully, add to a positive for the future of this city if I'm elected mayor.
Well, I can tell you that being home, kind of recuperating for my shoulder surgery, I've had to watch a lot of TV. I've seen a lot of you. I'm glad you finally shifted the commercials a little bit.
You know, the problem with the, as you know, the media today, there's so many ways people
Lots of problems about the media today.
And you waste a lot of money because you have a TV market, at least, that's 9 million people and only about 650,000 vote in a mayoral primary, a mayoral election. So you've got to expend a lot to affect a lot. So,
well, and obviously the tagline is no more excuses.
Yep.
Explain that to me.
Look, there are lots of people in this race who have been around politics for a long time, in elective office, 20, 30 years, you know, all sorts of things, and they now act like they haven't been there and they're going to solve everything. We've had lots of excuses by the system over the years, whether it's crime, whether it's the economic future of this city. Obviously, the state has its own problems, which are much, much worse than even the city's. And you've got a lot of people that I think are the public who are really frustrated with the lack of progress. Now, we had 4 years of a battle between the former governor and the legislature where nothing was done and progress was not made on much, if at all. And I think people are fed up with that. We've got a lot of problems. You see the numbers of people moving, the disenchantment with the system. And I think people are tired of the excuses. They just want to see some progress made on some of these issues.
Well, I saw that tagline also as a reference to the current mayor.
Well, no, I'm not. You know what? I'm trying to avoid blaming. Look, there are problems that every mayor, every city councilman, every legislator, every governor has not addressed and solved. So that's the reality of it. Whether it's the pension problem, obviously the crime problem, there's progress being made in some ways. But overall, we had 20 people shot this weekend. I don't see any great outrage by anybody today. I don't see a state's attorney or someone having some press conference or the legislature. I've not seen one word where the legislature is trying to deal with the crisis that is in not only this city around guns, but other parts of the state. So I would hope that that there's a bit of a rage. I've spent a lot of time throughout this city, and people are fed up with the taxes. They're fed up with the crime situation. And if you perceive you have a crime problem, I don't care what neighborhood it is in the city, if you perceive it, then there is a problem there.
I want to talk about taxes because you've talked about, you know, freezing property taxes. Obviously, the city's share of property taxes, I mean, the bulk of property taxes are education-related. But, you know, where does the revenue come from as the city, you know, still needs to deal with issues like its unfunded pension liability?
Right. Look, I've said there has been some stability in the short-term finances of the city, obviously, because of rather large property tax increases by Mayor Emanuel, which he saw that as a necessity to stabilize the city, the finances of the city. And I do think there, and I've said I will freeze property taxes, and if after the first year I have to raise property taxes in the city portion of this, the budget that I would control the minute I come in for the 2020 budget, then in the second year, if I have to raise property taxes, I would have a dollar cut for every dollar. We have to get serious about our financial problems. I've said also, everything should be on the table and all the revenue things, but we must address the other side of the table, and that is reform of the pension system. You cannot do that in an honest way unless we change the Constitution. I said this to the Chicago Federation of Labor so that we could have an honest negotiation, not to put all of the pain on retirees. I don't believe that's the right way to do it. On the other hand, you can't just put the pain on the taxpayers. We have 50,000 retirees, 35,000 present employees in the city. That's 85,000 people. That's about 3% of the population of the city. And that amounts to $28 billion of an obligation on the people who remain here in the city going forward. Many retirees, when they retire, it's their right, obviously, they move, they leave. The rest of the people who are here, or we are trying to get here to move here, have to pay off that obligation, which will go on for years. And we've got to be honest with ourselves and say we cannot have a serious negotiation unless we address this in a way that has to remove the barriers to honest negotiations on the reform of the system and not just look at revenue. As I said, I'm open to, I've named even a commuter tax as a possibility that a lot of people screamed at me about. All I'm saying is all of those things, real estate transfer tax, casinos, marijuana, all of that has to be on the table. But you must address the other side of the table, or else you're just, again, kicking the can, which everyone has done, and the impact of it is only going to get worse.
Well, as I spoke with Representative David McSweeney in the earlier segment, we were talking about, you know, he fashioned some idea of kind of on the Springfield state level of a grand kind of compromise. Again, you know, you can have agreement with unions, but you know, and it all takes is one member to sue.
Well, that's what happened. Mayor Emanuel did a couple of small deals with some unions to try to begin to change it. And I don't think those union leaders are trying to sell out their retirees or their members. I don't believe that. But even those minor attempts were thrown out by the court because of a blanket Supreme Court decision saying basically that you cannot make any changes. So that's the box we're all in. And we either change that box, again, not for the purpose of screwing the retirees, but having an honest negotiation to try to make progress on this problem. Because without progress on this problem, the long-term fiscal future of this city is at great peril.
But can you use a constitutional amendment? We're talking about the pension protection clause, right, which prevents which says that pensions are a contractual obligation, right, cannot be diminished or impaired. Right. But even if a constitutional amendment were to get through to change that or get rid of that clause, it would be prospective, wouldn't it? You couldn't affect current benefits.
Well, that's a question that would have to be litigated, obviously. And again, I'm not one who believes, because I think the vast majority of people, obviously, who have worked for government and are on pensions, they have a right, and we have an obligation to them for their service. Now, the truth is, when these rather compared to the private sector, benefits were given to public employees, it was at a time when their salaries competitive.
Yes, it was a disparity that was took the cheaper salary in public service because that was your parachute.
Now, a third of the city employees make over $100,000. Okay, so that reason for having that system is changed dramatically. And those unions and those people who obviously work for the city want those higher salaries, but we can't do it all. And, you know, what's also different about government, as we all know, as opposed to the private sector, is people go into government and as soon as they join, they expect to be there for 20, 30 years. And that's not the case in a dynamic changing economy like we have today in everything but government. And I think there's got to be a look at that and say, how do you get fresh people into government without the idea that, okay, once I get there, I'm there for at least 20 years, if not 30 years. And that's some sort of contractual seemingly obligation. The economy and the world is too, and young people especially, most of them have 3, 4, 5, 6 different jobs in their lives. They don't just go and sit at one job for those dynamic, innovative people that we need.
It sounds like a term limit on length of employment.
You know, I'm not saying there ought to be a term limit, but I think we ought to look at sort of government. One of the things I'm trying to do, Rick, is say the government basically is structured as it was at the first half, at least the first half, if not earlier, than the last century. That's why I propose changing the size of the city council. I've said we ought to think about combining CPS and city colleges. Look at doing things differently, because I think we're almost a quarter of the way through the 21st century and living with structures that were basically created at a very different time in our country is ridiculous, because no industry, no companies are still structured as they were, except government, at the first half, if not the first quarter, of the last century.
We're speaking with William Daley, candidate for mayor of the city of Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin. Welcome back to your Sunday Spin. I'm Rick Pearson from the Chicago Tribune, here in the Allstate Skyline studio with Bill Daley, candidate for mayor of Chicago. Your TV ads stress the idea that the prosperity of the Loop has been reserved largely for the Loop and has not reached out to many of the city neighborhoods. How do you incentivize, how do you encourage that development?
I would just expand it a little. It's not just the Loop. When you go near west, near south, now,
understood, but you use the term loop specifically.
Yeah, because I think that's how people identify, you know, the progress when you look at the shiny buildings. There's no doubt the disparity between the economic boom in some parts of the city, namely down here, and South Side, West Side, West Side, which for 50 years has been basically abandoned in many ways, even though there are bright spots happening. I think there's a combination of two things. One, I've laid out an attempt to using economic opportunity funds and working with the private sector. Those are massive funds that have been raised around the country for investment in economic opportunity zones as a result of the Trump. You've got the earned market tax credits. You've got other incentives, TIFs, and the extra TIF money that Emanuel set up in a fund to use to invest. But the real question is, how do we incentivize, and some of those things do, the private sector to go into parts of the city and help revitalize them? I was with Bobby Rush yesterday out in on 79th Street.
Who recently endorsed me.
And with a community meeting and a number of people sitting there talking about how do we get entrepreneurship back? You know, we had about 400,000 African-Americans leave over the last 40 years. The heart of the middle-class black moved to the suburbs. Now, they weren't allowed to move to the suburbs before the early 80s. That's reality. But you had so many businesses. You had the Johnsons, John Johnson, George Johnson. You had Jacoby Dickens. You had insurance businesses owned by black Southside entrepreneurs. We've got to try to recreate and help young people recreate that entrepreneurship and get young African-Americans, college graduates, entrepreneurs back into the city, into the neighborhoods where maybe their parents or grandparents lived, and try to find a way to support them, how to get capital to them and invest in them and work with the business community. I spent the vast majority of my life in the private sector as opposed to most of the candidates who are either career politicians or people who have been government employees, bureaucrats, whatever, servants, public servants. Most of my career has been in the private sector. So I think I have a understanding of the business community, and I think we've got to approach them in a way and say, look, we have to view a challenge of making this city more inclusive, wherever the jobs are. You know, some people say, oh, you just got to put jobs out in certain neighborhoods. We've got to make people able to do the jobs wherever the jobs are, and especially the younger people be ready for that. That's one of the reasons I talk about joining CPS and community colleges, to get kids trained for the jobs of the future, as opposed to we celebrate the fact that more CPS kids are going to college, but only 18% finish a four-year college in 6 years. So those who don't, what are they left with? Probably a lot of debt and no real skills to go in and get a job. And there's plenty of jobs today, and the expectation of the future is with an associate degree and the right training, these young men and women can be ready for these jobs of the future. And those who want to finish 4 years, go on to be brain surgeons and lawyers and doctors and everything else, they will do that. And they have that talent, those who do, and the ability. But the vast majority of us aren't in that level, to be frank with you.
You touched on the economic opportunity zones, and that's something also Representative McSweeney talked about in the earlier segment. But I'm not seeing how that's either at the state or city level about the activity there.
We have not seen. Now, it's relatively new. It just was part of the Trump tax bill. And I'll tell you, nationally, there's hundreds. I talked to one of the big developers who has a fund. He's out now in California doing economic investments in economic opportunity zones. So I've met with him and said, what do we do here? What has to be done here to support those? And not just investments in office buildings or apartment buildings. We have to find a way, and I'd love to work with Senator Booker and Senator Scott, who were the architects of the economic opportunity. How do we help bring manufacturing. I've laid out a plan for advanced manufacturing, and not just focus on either retail or apartment buildings or office buildings.
The infrastructure part. I mean, that's what's been talked about.
But the infrastructure,
you got to have that.
But the city can provide that. But what has to happen is the private sector has to come in. The city obviously can put some seed money in infrastructure, or use eminent domain, which I'll be very happy to use if it's a project that can really change an area and help an area grow and change from what it may have been for the last 50 years. So I think we've got to be very creative and very aggressive on trying to make the billions of dollars that have been invested in economic opportunity funds around the country focus here in Chicago, and what is it that we have to do to entice them to do that, those investments here as opposed to in California or some other city?
One last thing, and obviously the Daily Name is synonymous with Chicago. Is there daily fatigue?
There are plenty of people who have an honest question about that. All I can ask, Rick, is my career is very different than my brother or my father. They were career politicians, all due respect to that decision they made. I took a different path. All I can ask people is to judge me as to who I am and what I've done and what I'm laying out. I think people are fair in Chicago. I love this city. We've spent our whole life here. Kids, grandkids, all of that, like so many families. I'm concerned about the future, and at this stage of my life, I'm not doing it for another job or run for another office. I'm trying to be helpful to the city because I love the city and want to be part of the improving it.
That's William Daley, candidate for mayor of the city of Chicago. I'm Rick Pearson. This is the Sunday Spin.